Content warning: the first poem we read contains references to suicide.
Bee for the honey, bee, bee for the, bee for the honey, bee, bee for the.
This is KSKD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM. I'm Deanna Riley, and this is the Hive Poetry Collective, when we talk to all sorts of poets about all sorts of poetry. We also have live events approximately every other month at Bookshop Santa Cruz, where we bring poets in from all over the country and local poets too. You can find out about that at hivepoetry.org. Go to our events page there. You can find us on Facebook at the Hive Poetry Collective on KSQD and on Instagram and Twitter. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to the great Edward Hirsch. Edward Hirsch is a MacArthur Fellow, has published 10 books of poems, including The Living Fire, Gabriel, a poem, and Stranger by Night. He has also published 6 prose books about poetry, among them How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, which we're not going to be talking a lot about today, but I highly recommend. It was a national bestseller, and also 100 Poems to Break Your Heart and The Heart of American Poetry. He is president of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
It's really a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
I am reading The Living Fire, Your New and Selected Poems, which is a lovely book. And I have greatly enjoyed 100 Poems to Break Your Heart. And I would like to read from both today. Before I begin, I want to ask you a quick question, because when I was reading your bio, I thought to myself, wow, 10 books of poetry. Can you just tell me, when you publish a book of poems today, how it feels different from that very first one you published so long ago?
That's an interesting and odd question. I don't know the answer to that, because everything changes so gradually as you go, and you're never sure of what's going to happen. And so it always feels like a miracle. But I do remember when my first book, For the Sleepwalkers, came in the mail, and I burst out crying and then said, let's go for ice cream. that seemed to capture it right there, because it suggested that I might be able to have the life I dreamed of and imagined, and that I wouldn't be kept from it. I wouldn't say so much now, but the difference between a first book and a second book and all subsequent books is quite great, I would say. And that's because a first book is kind of best hits, usually, and it takes a very long time, and it's written on hope, and it goes through so many different incarnations, at least it did in my case. I didn't really imagine it quite as a book, because I had so many different envisionings of it. Starting with my second book, Wild Gratitude, I began to have a sense of how a book might cohere and how a collection of poems might be more than the sum of its parts. And so I began to think more about books as a whole in a way I couldn't do in my first book.
Mm. Good answer. Thank you. Yeah, I felt like when my first book got published that it was something I had never dreamed of. It was just
it's really a thrill, and it's always exciting and never can be sure of what's going to happen, that you're going to be able to even write a poem or write a book of poems, but there's nothing like the first shot.
It's just like the first shot of heroin.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that.
All right, let's jump into 100 Poems to Break Your Heart. Why don't we just jump right into the first poem, and then we can talk a little bit more about how you put a collection like this together, an anthology together, and some other things about the anthology. But The Gas Poker is the first one we're going to read. Is there something you want to say about it before we begin, or should we jump right in?
I think that probably people, everyone who knows about poetry, cares about poetry in California, knows about Tom Gunn, I hope, who was a great Anglo-American poet with a serious formal intelligence. I'd say he had a warm heart and a cool head. And this is an incredible poem that he wrote about his mother called The Gas Poker. 48 years ago, can it be 48 since then? They forced the door, which she had barricaded with a full bureau's weight, lest anyone find, as they did, what she had blocked it for. She had blocked the doorway so to keep the children out. In her red dressing gown, she wrote notes, all night busy, pushing the things about, thinking till she was dizzy before she'd lain down. The children went to and fro on the harsh winter lawn, repeating their lament, a burden to each other in the December dawn, elder and younger brother, till they knew what it meant. Knew all there was to know, coming back off the grass to the room of her release. They who had been her treasures knew to turn off the gas, take the appropriate measures, telephone the police. One image from the flow sticks in the stubborn mind, a sort of backwards flute, the poker that she'd held up, breathed from the holes aligned into her mouth till, filled up by its music, she was mute.
This is a shattering poem. I just want to say that was Ed Hirsch reading The Gas Poker by Tom Gunn from Ed Hirsch's anthology of poems, 100 Poems to Break Your Heart. Yeah, that's a tough one.
We probably should have started with a warning.
I know. I'll put it at the beginning.
Because I think this is just, it's a shattering poem. It took Tom Gunn nearly 50 years to write it. That is the time between his mother's suicide and that he found a way to write this poem, which he had not been able to do till then. He initially was going to call it The Instrument and then hit upon calling it The Gas Poker. But of course, when you first read it and hear about it, you don't know what the gas poker is. You think it's just for poking the fire. And then it turns out to have a much more shattering and devastating feeling. One thing I'd say about writing poetry, as opposed to, say, writing diary entries, is no matter how shattering the subject matter, it takes a certain distance to write a poem about something like this. It took Tom Gunn a long time. And what the major formal decision that enabled him to write this poem was to turn it into the third person. There's a moment where he breaks from that right at the beginning, where he goes, 48 years ago, and then between dashes, can it be 48 since then? You hear him asking himself that question. But after that, he doesn't break, and it stays in the third person for him and his brother. And somehow,
but I think that's a really smart decision to have that little voicey break right there where he's kind of questioning himself, because you know that even though it's in the third person, that it's really about himself, or that he was involved.
That's right.
Somehow. And when it says down below, it says one image in the flow sticks in the stubborn mind. And you know it's not his mind, but somehow, because of the way he set it up at the beginning, that it's sticking in his mind, not...
Yes, it's in the third person, but you also know that it's overflowing from the first person and that he's somehow distancing himself by thinking about it in the third person. And then, of course, he's also doing that through rhyming.
Yeah, the rhyme is amazing in this poem because you barely notice it.
I know. It's because of the distance of the rhymes. The way that he uses this sort of scheme where the words are not rhyming next to each other. So, for example, you'll have the word so in one stanza rhyming with the word fro in another stanza. And so they're far away from each other.
But all the stanzas begin with that same O sound. A go, so, fro, no, flow. Which is,
gives it a song-like quality, but also you don't hear it as rhyming because they're just, each one is six lines away. You think of a refrain rhyme like that is at the end of a stanza, but he uses it at the beginning of a stanza.
Like a backward guzzle.
Like a backward guzzle.
Yeah.
As you know, he's a very skillful poet.
He's got an A, B, let's see, he's got eight and wait, door and four. So it's a super, super tight rhyme scheme, and yet you don't hear it, which goes along with your description of him at the beginning as being what? You said he was formal, yet formal intelligence, a warm heart and a cool head. So it's really heartfelt. It's yes. So emotional. I mean, it's incredibly, horribly emotional. One image from the flow sticks in the stubborn mind, a sort of backwards flute, the poker that she held up, breathed from the holes aligned into her mouth till filled up by its music, she was mute. I mean, just that horrible image, and so out of control, the situation, but the poem is so controlled.
Yes, and the tightness that it would take on yourself to describe himself and his brother, discovering his mother, her treasures. I think even more, though, that the most extraordinary thing about this is there's no blame.
Right.
There's no blame on the mother. It comes to her his understanding that she somehow tried to protect them, and a sign of her practicality, the way she tried to block the door, and the way she wrote notes. Nonetheless, she couldn't protect herself or protect her two treasures. There's no blame of her for that, though, although you know that this experience of discovering his mother with his younger brother is probably the most shattering thing that ever happened to him.
Yeah, I was really, really very moved by this poem and that complicated symbol at the end of the gas poker. I guess it's kind of an objective correlative in a way, holding
correct
emotion in the poem, that something that makes music. And I think you said something that there's something symbolic about a flute. I think you said something about
the flute is the instrument of elegy historically, and he compares the gas poker to a flute, and he sees the correlation between it. That's why it was originally called the instrument.
I see. And it's a backward flute. So instead of her blowing into it, it's blowing into her. Instead of it making music, it's ending the music of her life.
That's right.
So this fantastic poem. I have actually a ton of notes on this. We probably should move on so we can read even more. But that was a heart-stopping. Well, the book is called 100 Poems to Break Your Heart. They're not all that intense. There's a great variety of tone, and it's chronological, right? And it starts pretty far back in time. So it's almost like you get a little history lesson while you're reading it too. It starts with some romantic poems and
it's two centuries of poems. There are two decisions that I made it begins with Wordsworth and his tremendous poem, Surprised by Joy. That's what it's called, but it didn't have a title. Surprised by Joy, Impatient as the Wind is the first line. My decision was to include two centuries of poems and also not to limit myself to English language poems or to poems just from England and the United States. It's an international anthology. One of the tricks the gun poem sets this up. I think you can see it quite clearly of the problem of the book or the issue of the book, as far as I'm concerned, writing it, which is every one of the 100 poems that I'm writing about has a very steep personal story. These are not just language games. This is not language play or free-floating linguistics. Everything, there's something really deeply at stake in every one of these poems for the poet and the person who wrote this poem. So you want to honor the human being who wrote this and the suffering that's involved. At the same time, they're writing poems. The oldest word for poet in Greek is poesis, or the oldest word for poetry in Greek is poesis, which means making. And a poet is a maker, and a poem is a made thing. And these poets are transforming their grief into made things. So in writing about them and choosing them, I tried to think hard about how to honor the human story behind the poem, as in the Tom Gunn story, but also then paying particular attention to how it operates as a poem and how one's grief is transformed and turned into the art of poetry.
What was that term you used? Steep personal
story, I think, but maybe
steep
not.
Personal story, yeah. A lot of stakes.
Yeah, there are every one of these poems has a story behind it that's very, very intense.
Mm-hmm. And highly crafted. Yeah, so the Tom Gunn one is a really, really, really strong example of that, of kind of Dionysian and Apollonian, of just the wildness of the emotion, and yet how contained and how crafted.
That's a feature of Tom Gunn's work. He was a student of Ivor Winter's at Stanford, and he loved Ben Jonson and English Renaissance poetry. But he couldn't, he moved to California for a reason, and rode motorcycles, and there's a certain kind of wildness in his poetry and in his life, but also tightly controlled formally in terms of his poetics. And that's, I think, the energy that you're describing is this Dionysian spirit in this Apollonian form.
Mm. All right, well, let's read this next one by Heather McHugh, What He Thought.
This is dedicated to someone named Fabio Doplicher, What He Thought. We were supposed to do a job in Italy, and full of our feeling for ourselves, our sense of being poets from America, we went from Rome to Fano, met the mayor, mulled a couple matters over. What's a cheap date, they asked us. What's flat drink? Among Italian literati, we could recognize our counterparts, the academic, the apologist, the arrogant, the amorous, the brazen and the glib. And there was one administrator, the conservative, in suit of regulation gray, who, like a good tour guide with measured pace and uninflected tone, narrated sights and histories the hired van hauled us past. Of all, he was the most politic and least poetic, so it seemed. Our last few days in Rome, when all but three of the New World bards had flown, I found a book of poems this unprepossessing one had written. It was there in the pensione room, a room he'd recommended, where it must have been abandoned by the German visitor. Was there a bus of them to whom he had inscribed and dated it a month before? I couldn't read Italian either, so I put the book back into the wardrobe's dark. We last Americans were due to leave tomorrow. For our parting evening then, our host chose something in a family restaurant. And there we sat and chatted, sat and chewed, till, sensible it was our last big chance to be poetic, make our mark. One of us asked, what's poetry? Is it the fruits and vegetables and marketplace of Campo di Fiori, or the statue there? Because I was the glib one, I identified the answer instantly. I didn't have to think. The truth is both. It's both, I blurted out. But that was easy. That was easiest to say. What followed taught me something about difficulty, for our underestimated host spoke out all of a sudden with a rising passion. And he said, the statue represents Giordano Bruno, brought to be burned in the public square because of his offense against authority, which is to say the church. His crime was his belief the universe does not revolve around the human being. God is no fixed point or central government, but rather is poured in waves through all things. All things move. If God is not the soul itself, he is the soul of the world. Such was his heresy. The day they brought him forth to die, they feared he might incite the crowd. The man was famous for his eloquence. And so his captors placed upon his face an iron mask in which he could not speak. That's how they burned him. That's how he died, without a word, in front of everyone. And poetry, we'd all put down our forks by now to listen to the man in gray, he went on softly. Poetry is what he thought, but did not say.
That was Ed Hirsch reading Heather McHugh's What He Thought from Ed Hirsch's anthology, 100 Poems to Break Your Heart, which was is a HarperCollins book. Wow. This time when I was reading it, I was noticing how at the end, when she says, and poetry, then she has a parenthesis, we'd all put down our forks by now to listen to the man in gray. He went on softly. That parenthesis there, like you're on the edge of your seat, and she delays the moment when she comes in with that final strong point. After this meandering story, which really begins to pick up heat, when he said, God is no fixed point or central government, but rather is poured in waves through all things move. If God is not the soul itself, he is the soul of the world. So it really begins to pick up heat right around that point. And then you're kind of left on tenterhooks waiting.
You're completely right about this and poetry. And then she pauses. And I think this is not only that he's speaking to everyone in the room at the table, put down their forks and listen, but it's a notice to us to put down our forks and listen too, because it's underlining what he's about to say. And she's raised the stakes or the bar really high here, because we put down our forks and listen too. And you go, what is poetry? And now he's actually going to try and tell us.
Yeah. And so it ends with this kind of piece of exposition defining poetry.
Exactly. What I like about the perspective of the speaker in this poem is that if you know Heather McHugh's work, you know how incredibly witty she is and how linguistically oriented and how quick her poems are. And her weakest poems, I'd say, are just language play, but there's always some kind of verbal fireworks going on in her incredible intelligence and wit. But here, she identifies herself as the glib one. And what she says initially is ultimately criticized by herself and ultimately by the person that I think is saying that, who I think is the person whom the poem is dedicated to, but I don't have any proof of that. But it's this Italian poet who looks like an administrator, who's not glib at all, who's sort of a grayish person that everyone's kind of looked it up. He's been the host. He's the one who delivers the news.
The guy whose book no one reads.
Exactly.
Because it's not in English.
Exactly. And also who's just people been rude to because he's just been showing them around.
Yeah. But here's a question I had when I read it. That last line kind of reminded me of that poem by Auden that begins about suffering. The old masters were never wrong. The last line is a piece of exposition where you kind of go, okay, that's what poetry is. But then when you stop and think about it, you go, well, is that what poetry is? Like, you just believe it when you hear it.
Completely true. It feels completely right. But
yeah.
I wrote a book called The Poet's Glossary, and my entry for poetry is very long, and it goes through about 50 or 60 things that different people say of what poetry is, and no one definition is actually accurate. I think what's powerful about this, I mean, I would not say that this is true of all poetry. Poetry is what he thought but did not say. That's just not technically accurate for all poems by any means. But in the dramatic situation of this poem, you realize there's something very profound in the definition of poetry here.
Mm-hmm. But I do believe that most poets are people that have been silenced at some point and need to speak.
It's absolutely the case that poetry, one feels urgently, I mean, depending how they've been silenced or who has silenced them or how they've silenced themselves, people certainly resort to poetry because they can't do anything else and they feel the need to speak, and that the definition of poetry here comes out of the urgent need to tell something to someone who's not physically present to you.
That's
the impulse.
Well, let's move on so that we can get through lots of poems. And why don't we read, speaking of an urgency to speak to someone that you can't speak to, why don't we go ahead and read Marie Howe's wonderful What the Living Do?
This is a poem addressed to her brother, Johnny, who died from AIDS complications in 1989. And she came up with a strategy here that was the opposite of the Tom Gunn strategy. That is, one assumed that Tom Gunn was trying for decades to write about his mother's death, but was never able to do it. It was only when he figured out how to do it in the third person and remove it. Marie Howe is just the opposite. She's trying to write a traditional elegy for her brother, Johnny, and wasn't able to do it, and finally decided to write him a letter. Johnny, the kitchen sink has been clogged for days. Some utensil probably fell down there, and the Drano won't work, but smells dangerous. And the crusty dishes have piled up, waiting for the plumber I still haven't called. This is the everyday we spoke of. It's winter again. The sky's a deep, headstrong blue, and the sunlight pours through the open living room windows because the heat's on too high in here, and I can't turn it off. For weeks now, driving or dropping a bag of groceries in the street, the bag breaking, I've been thinking, this is what the living do. And yesterday, hurrying along those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, spilling my coffee down my wrist and sleeve, I thought it again, and again later, when buying a hairbrush. This is it. Parking. Slamming the car door shut in the cold. What you called that yearning. What you finally gave up. We want the spring to come and the winter to pass. We want whoever to call or not call. A letter, a kiss. We want more and more and then more of it. But there are moments, walking, when I catch a glimpse of myself in the window glass, say, the window of the corner video store, and I'm gripped by a cherishing so deep for my own blowing hair, chapped face, and unbuttoned coat that I'm speechless. I'm living. I remember you.
That was Marie Howe's What the Living Do. That was Ed Hirsch reading it. It is anthologized in his book, 100 Poems to Break Your Heart. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM. I'm Deanna Riley. This is the Hive Poetry Collective. You can find us at hivepoetry.org. You can look at our events page and see who we have coming in town to read next at Bookshop Santa Cruz. This poem, oh my gosh, I've read it so many times and I always get something new out of it. This time reading it, I was really struck by how strongly she evokes, I guess what you'd call the lyric moment, a really strong moment of revelation where she just sinks into a moment of pure presence and pure awareness of being alive. And it's so powerful, contrasted with of course, the death of the brother. And it's brought about through a sense of awe of everyday life.
Correct. It's the dailiness of life has a kind of incarnational quality, I'd say, a kind of vividness that just what Virginia Woolf called moments of being. It has a quality of the moments of being. One of the things I'd point out to you is that Marie Howe forged this, she said, as a letter to her brother, and that enabled her to write it. But in my opinion, it's an extremely strange letter. I mean, if you're writing a letter to your brother who's died, you'd think you might say, here's how mom's doing. Here's what all our brothers and sisters are doing. Here's what's been happening since you've been gone. It doesn't do any of that. Instead, it's a kind of setup to talk to him about daily life that he's been missing.
Yeah.
And it's the gravity of what's happened to him and the incarnational quality of everyday life, what she calls that yearning, that desire, what he called that yearning, really, that desire, that need to be alive. And she's remarkably, she captures it for us too. I mean, you see her on the sidewalk in Cambridge, spilling a bag, spilling coffee, getting caught in that those horrible sidewalks. You just all have that feeling that you're right there with her. It's a poem of incredible presence.
It's so vivid. But there are moments walking when I catch a glimpse of myself in the window glass, say the window of the corner video store. I think that there, that specificity, it also places it in time now.
Yeah, I thought that same thing. There aren't any video stores anymore. Yeah.
The window of the, and I'm gripped by a cherishing so deep for my own blowing hair, chapped face, and unbuttoned coat that I'm speechless. And then that those two really short sentences after these super, super long, like almost Whitman-like sentences, I am living. I remember you.
That's all she can say.
Yeah, she's so
overwhelmed by the moment.
Yeah. Overwhelmed, right. I actually never really thought about it as a letter. I thought of it just more as like an apostrophe, just a talking to someone who's not there. I never really thought about it as a letter until I actually read what you wrote about it and read that she always wrote him letters. So that's kind of what it was, just another letter to him. I always just thought she was just like talking to him.
Yes, I see why. I mean, I read about this, so I picked it up. Mm-hmm. But it has the same quality, I think, of what you're talking to, as if she's speaking. The point was, the poem took off when she decided to speak directly to him.
Yeah.
Whether as if he's physically there or through a letter, she's addressing him and doing that, talking as if to him, even though he's not there, is what gives the poem its velocity, its torque.
Yeah, I guess it's just figuring out how to come in slant, figuring out how to come into that powerful emotion, like how to get it into some kind of form. That's the trick.
This is the issue of writing poetry. I mean, this is, you've got these, you know, deep, steep stories, as I say, of anguish that drives people, or over joy sometimes, but also often tremendous grief that drove people to it. But you can't get away from the fact that you're still trying to make something and that you still need to figure out how to do that. And you're writing a poem about, you know, to your dead brother, but you still have to decide how long the line's going to be and whether they should be in stanzas and how metaphors work and what to describe. I mean, you just can't, that's writing poetry. You can't get away from the fact that you are engaging in the technical parts of poetry. And people who don't think about that, I suppose, tend to write worse poems. Because this will, you're going to put them in lines or not in lines no matter what. And so it's better to have a sense of what the line can do than not.
Yeah.
And in this poem, I would point out that the poem's in two line stanzas and the lines are very long. And the reason I think that matters is that the iambic pentameter base is the baseline for speech in English language poetry.
So that means 10 syllables.
10 syllables, yes. Right. And that's the baseline. So when you feel that, that's the closest to speech. Whenever poets historically, until the 20th century, but even well into the 20th century, wanted to bring a poem closer to speech, the way, say, Wordsworth did or Frost did, they turned, those who wrote in traditional rhyme and meter, turned to iambic pentameter, 5 beats, 10 syllables. Now, what that meant as a baseline is that when you have poems in really short lines, you often feel that something's been taken away. And when you feel poems that are in longer lines, as this one is, you feel that something's been added on. And that it's often the case that poems in longer lines create a quality of trance, or reverie or dream, or as in the Hebrew Bible, prophecy. And so even though this poem is very chatty to her brother, the tip off of the long lines, the Whitmanian lines, because Whitman got, you know, Whitman brought this into American poetry, but he got it from the King James Bible. This use of this longer line, I think, is a tip off to the fact that this isn't just a realistic daily poem, but also a visionary one. And it's a key to what you pointed out right at the beginning, that this is a poem that's about a luminous moment.
Yeah, because it's almost like escaping the boundary of the page.
That's right.
It's almost like you're leaving this world for another one. It's like that idea, there is another world and it's this one. And you're using the line to just probe into some other bigger space.
Precisely. And this long line, which, say, Allen Ginsberg used so well in Howl and Kaddish, is a line of visionary power. And it always has been in American poetry. And I think that Marie Howe is able to get that quality in this poem, which ostensibly is about the everyday and about dailiness. But it's the dailiness, the sacredness of that in relationship to the fact that someone she really loved has died.
Yeah, the sacredness of the kitchen sink being clogged and the Drano smells dangerous and the crusty dishes.
Yeah, it's all the everyday.
Yeah, it turns it into something just so luminous and alive. Are you particularly interested in the luminous and the visionary and that other world in poetry?
Very much so. Not exclusively, but I'm interested in how the prophetic mode works. And
where does that interest come from, do you think?
I think it came from reading certain poems that transported me. And that I felt the shock and the excitement of these poems, but I didn't know why I felt it. And as I began to, so I think it came from like reading Christopher Smart or reading William Blake or reading Whitman. And then discovering that there were certain poets who were doing things in contemporary poetry, like when I was coming up, say, Galway Canal or Alan Grossman or Muir Rukeyser, who were using this long line. And I go, what's going on here? And so I began to tried to think harder about how this line worked and how these visionary poems got their transcendental effects. It always with me, it started with my response to certain poems.
Did you have an experience of like reading, say, you know, the Torah or biblical stuff when you were young?
No, I can't say. I mean, I did, but I can't say I had much of an experience of that. Mm-hmm. I think I came to that, the power of the Hebrew Bible, through reading certain poets, Christopher Smart especially. But Blake and Whitman, as I mentioned, all of whom owe their prophetic vision to the Hebrew Bible. So I go, what's going on here? And then I began to see how the King James Bible has, you know, which is the basis of prose in English, has just the most magnificent prose and visionary poetry, really. Yeah. So my response has always been, these poems are moving to me. What's going on here? Yeah. So instead of starting, I didn't start with like, oh, this is a sonnet. How did this, what's a sonnet? I began with a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, I Wake and Feel the Fell of Dark, Not Day, one of the so-called terrible sonnets. And then I'm like, this has got the most unbelievable desolation I've ever seen in a poem. How did he do it? Holy cow, this thing is a sonnet.
Yeah, you know what? And that's the opposite of the way it's often taught in high school. It's like, what is a sonnet? Iambic pentameter, A-B-A-B rhyme. They start with the form and not so good at
now healing. You know, you got, just to parenthetically, now you know the premise of how to read a poem and fall in love with poetry. That is, poetry was taught this way. That's the wrong way. Here's what I believe is the right way. That is, no one great in poetry wrote poetry because they go, oh, great, I want to write a sonnet. But the sonnet does do tremendous work, and the sonnets didn't work. But they wrote it because they wanted to make a kind of argument, and the sonnet seemed the best way to do that. So for me, it always started with, what's the emotional stake in this? What's the reason for this? And how does that lead to the form? Rather than starting with the way it was taught to us, here's the form. This is a Petrarchan sonnet. This is a Shakespearean sonnet. It's 14 lines. It rhymes this way. And you're sitting in class going, who cares?
I hate this. That's what you're thinking.
Exactly. You're thinking, I hate this. And exactly. And that's why people hate poetry. They didn't start out that way. Our teachers taught them to.
Yeah.
And so how to read a poem begins with the premise of, you read this poem and it moves you. And you go, well, what's going on here?
Yeah, you have to let yourself feel.
That's right. That's where it starts.
You have to be open to feeling. You have to be a little vulnerable and let the poem in. Let's jump into some of your poems now. Let's start with For the Sleepwalkers. When I read this poem, it reminded me that my sister used to sleepwalk. I had forgotten.
She did?
Yeah.
She was in touch with her unconscious, or at least troubled.
No comment.
Yeah. Okay. Let's leave that. We're the sleepwalkers. Tonight, I want to say something wonderful for the sleepwalkers who have so much faith in their legs, so much faith in the invisible arrow carved into the carpet, the worn path that leads to the stairs instead of the windows, the gaping doorway instead of the seamless mirror. I love the way that sleepwalkers are willing to step out of their bodies into the night, to raise their arms and welcome the darkness, palming the blank spaces, touching everything. Always they return home safely, like blind men who know it is morning by feeling the shadows. And always they wake up as themselves again. That's why I want to say something astonishing, like, our hearts are leaving our bodies. Our hearts are thirsty black handkerchiefs flying through the trees at night, soaking up the darkest beams of moonlight, the music of owls, the motion of wind-torn branches. And now our hearts are thick black fists flying back to the glove of our chests. We have to learn to trust our hearts like that. We have to learn the desperate faith of sleepwalkers who rise out of their calm beds and walk through the skin of another life. We have to drink the stupefying cup of darkness and wake up to ourselves, nourished and surprised.
Thank you. So we have jumped from the anthology that Edward Hirsch put together, 100 Poems to Break Your Heart. And we just read from his new and selected poems, The Living Fire. That was For the Sleepwalkers. I feel like now, this time reading it, that's a little bit of an Ars Poetica. It's a little bit of a, it kind of reminds me of writing poems in a way that we have to learn to trust our hearts like that. We have to learn the desperate faith of sleepwalkers who rise out of their calm beds and walk through the skin of another life. We have to drink the stupefying cup of darkness and wake up to ourselves, nourished and surprised. it did a little bit remind me of what one has to go through to write a poem.
Well, the poem is a hymn to the unconscious, because sleepwalkers are the physical embodiment of the unconscious moving. And so I can see why you're turning, I didn't write it intentionally as an Ars Poetica, but I think it's got that over that quality that you're remarking on, which is, as Shelley says in his defense of poetry, not even the greatest poet can say, I will write poetry, because poetry is never entirely at the dispensation of the will. There's always this unconscious element that's there in genuine poetry. And my poem not only acknowledges that, but praises it. It's a total hymn to that and to this power of the irrational, the demonic, the unconscious, which is so much a crucial part of what is poetry.
A kind of inner intelligence or an inner wisdom to tap
into. Correct. I mean, if you think of what's the difference between poetry and philosophy, you'd have to say in the ancient quarrel between poetry and philosophy, you'd have to say that associative, or what Keats called non-consecutive reasoning, is a feature of poetry, which is not a feature of philosophy.
Mm.
It's a different kind of logic, what I would call poetic logic, which is different than theoretical logic or philosophical logic. And to get that associative or non-consecutive logic, you need the element of the unconscious to kick in, which is why poets are so superstitious and nervous and maybe even neurotic, because you can't guarantee that you will be able to be in touch with your unconscious and write a poem. It's never automatic.
Mm. I love how this poem begins. Tonight I want to say something wonderful. You know, I don't think any poetry teacher would ever tell someone to start a poem like that.
I loved it when I thought of it, I have to say, because absolutely not, because it's setting the stage that the expectation is so high. Like if you say tonight I want to say something wonderful, then you have to say something wonderful. And so the way I think of this is a series of upbeats and downbeats. So it's like, tonight I want to say something wonderful. You like something really, you have to say something extraordinary. Then there's something like a downbeat, like for the sleepwalkers who have so much faith in their legs. Well, that's not so remarkable.
But so much faith. So much faith. Faith
exactly.
Is that beat, but then the line break.
Correct.
In
their legs. And so that's, you're completely right. When you see it on the page, you see that it's going up and taking you down and going up and taking you down in terms of this. But, you know, later I do it again where I go, that's why I want to say something astonishing. And you got to then say something astonishing. Otherwise, people are going to go, hold it a second. That's not astonishing at all.
So you do say some like really like poetry, like poetry. I want to say something astonishing, like, and then in italics, our hearts are leaving our bodies. Our hearts are thirsty black handkerchiefs flying through the trees at night, soaking up the darkest beams of moonlight, the music of owls, the motion of wind-torn branches. And now our hearts are thick black fists flying back to the glove of our chest. So you have like a poem within a poem. And what you write is just really transcendent and what you would expect to be in a poem.
I think it's what you'd hope for if you're going to say something astonishing. But the thing about it is, I believe it's not just astonishing, because it turns out it also seems, I think, true of sleepwalkers. And then it makes the sleepwalkers into exemplary figures. I mean, it's a kind of moral or lesson, because it's finally, and it's very explicit about this, because it says, just like the sleepwalkers, we have to learn to trust our hearts like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a bit bullying, because it also says we have to learn, we have to drink. It's really trying to railroad you a little to think this, because it's a bit aggressive. But I believe, I'm hoping that the poem delivers on it, because what it's telling you is you have to do the most ordinary thing, the miracle of going to sleep and waking up.
Mm. Yeah, so it's a little bit like the Murray Howe, that quotidian, the
Very
element.
much, very much so.
The quotidian, and it's about entering another world. Yeah, I love this.
And if you're a lifelong insomniac, then you discover that it takes a certain kind of faith to go to sleep. And so you need to calm down enough that you can go to sleep and then trust that you can wake up nourished, and then the amazement of the world all over again.
Yeah. I love the way it gets kind of bullying at the end. We have to drink the stupefying cup of darkness. We have to do this. We have to do that. It's like people don't like to be ordered around, but somehow the poem softens you up, so you're willing to go, yes, I must do that. You're like,
if it operates in the poem, then I think, you know, you hope it works, because the poem has led you to this point within the logic of the poem.
I think we have time for one more of your poems. Let's see. We were going to do Wild Gratitude, and
we should go to special orders because it's shorter.
Yeah, we've got 5 minutes, so we could probably do Wild Gratitude. I think we could fit it in. We just won't talk a whole lot about it at the end.
Is that what you'd prefer?
I think that would be best. Yeah, yeah.
Wild Gratitude. Tonight when I knelt down next to our cat, Zoe, and put my fingers into her clean cat's mouth and rubbed her swollen belly that will never know kittens and watched her wriggle onto her side, pawing the air, and listened to her solemn little squeals of delight, I was thinking about the poet, Christopher Smart, who wanted to kneel down and pray without ceasing in every one of the splintered London streets, and was locked away in the madhouse at St. Luke's with his sad religious mania and his wild gratitude and his grave prayers for the other lunatics and his great love for a speckled cat, Jeffrey. All day today, August 13th, 1983, I remembered how Christopher Smart blessed this same day in August, 1759, for its calm bravery and ordinary good conscience. This was the day that he blessed the Postmaster General and all conveyancers of letters for their warm humanity, and the gardeners for their private benevolence and intricate knowledge of the language of flowers, and the milkmen for their universal human kindness. This morning I understood that he loved to hear, as I have heard, the soft clink of milk bottles on the rickety stairs in the early morning, and how terrible it must have seemed when even this small pleasure was denied him. But it wasn't until tonight when I knelt down and slipped my hand into Zoe's waggling mouth that I remembered how he'd called Jeffrey the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him, and for the first time understood what it meant. Because it wasn't until I saw my own cat whine and roll over on her fluffy back that I realized how gratefully he'd watched Jeffrey fetch and carry his wooden cork across the grass in the wet garden, patiently jumping over a high stick, calmly sharpening his claws on the wood pile, rubbing his nose against the nose of another cat, stretching, or slowly stalking his traditional enemy, the mouse. A rodent, a creature of great personal valor, and then dealing so much that his enemy escaped. And only then did I understand it is Jeffrey and every creature like him who can teach us how to praise, purring in their own language, wreathing themselves in the living fire.
That was Ed Hirsch reading from The Living Fire, New and Selected Poems. So that was the poem that you took the little phrase out to name your book. So it must be a special poem for you.
Very much so. I titled my second book Wild Gratitude, and then my New and Selected Poems comes from the last phrase in this, which is really meaningful to me, about immersing ourselves into the living fire.
And the living fire for you is?
Life itself, that where you can't hold yourself back. You have to throw yourself into experience itself, and you have to immerse yourself in the flow, give yourself up to it.
So Christopher Smart, who you are speaking about in this poem, and his famous poem is Jubilate Agni. Isn't that what it's called?
Jubilate Agno.
Jubilate Agno, about his cat Jeffrey, which I don't think I've read the whole. I don't think I've read the whole thing, but I've read like
The whole thing is tremendous. I give a reading of it in How to Read a Poem, and then focus on the part about Jeffrey. The part about Jeffrey is the most famous, but it's all part of the larger whole of an attempt to write his own liturgy. But the part about Jeffrey is taking this tremendously biblical language and use it to describe the actions of his cat, Jeffrey, and has a kind of comic holiness about it. It's funny and moving as well. And since he was writing it from a madhouse where he was confined, daily life has a kind of magical quality for him because he's cut out from it. And reading Smart and thinking about Smart playing with his cat, Jeffrey, and then doing the same thing so many years later with my own cat on the same day got me to paralleling. I mean, the structure of the poem is I do this, he does that. And thinking about parallel what I'm doing with what I'm reading in his poem and see where the two journeys lead you.
So I don't know much about the life of Christopher Smart, but was he a person that was just always in a state of praise, in a jubilant kind of state of praise? Is that why they put him away?
I think he had a kind of madness. He seemed like a certain kind of religious fanatic who lost it and was praying with people in Hyde Park and asking strangers to pray with him and couldn't control himself. Dr. Johnson said the most wonderful thing about this. Boswell told him that Christopher Smart was living in a kind of rooming house and wasn't changing his sheets and was stopping strangers on the street. He was called Kit Smart. And Johnson said, one would have to be mad not to want to pray with Kit Smart.
Mm.
But he wasn't a person made for this world, and he couldn't function in an ordinary world like John Clare. And so he was confined. And from there, he wrote this extraordinary liturgy, of which the part about Jeffrey is the most famous and the most remarkable.
Mm.
Highly recommend it to everyone. And one of the reasons that I'm happy about my poem is it points people to the section in Jubilate Agno that I'm referring to.
Well, I particularly like your poem because it is about gratitude, but it has duende in it. It's got darkness in it when you talk about Christopher Smart, who was locked away in the madhouse at St. Luke's with his sad religious mania. And later on, you do have some other stuff too. It's not all just wildly gratitude. It's got a tinge of darkness in it.
More than a tinge, I'd say. I think it's to get to this kind of gratitude, you, in my opinion, you have to go through the dark side. I'm not just saying bless you, everyone.
Right.
At all. Yeah. I'm sort of taking you through the darkness of this to come out the other side.
Well, I love this poem to end on, and I wish we could talk longer. I could go on and on. I really want to recommend to people that they buy all of your books. 100 Poems to Break Your Heart, though. Is that your newest one? That's your newest one, right?
But coming out after 100 Poems to Break Your Heart has just been this book about American poetry called The Heart of American Poetry.
Yeah, I have that one too. I have that one too. I'm going to read it next. Well, but it's time to go. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy. Bye.
This is KSQD Santa Cruz at 90.7 FM. I'm Deanna Riley, and this is the Hive Poetry Collective. Thank you for tuning in.